You know that feeling when you just know a word? It's right there, shimmering at the edge of your mind, but you can't quite grasp it.
Oh, yeah, the tip of the tongue thing.
Exactly. Or maybe you're chatting with a friend about something you both did, and your memories of it are just wildly different. It's like our brains are playing little tricks.
Those moments are so common, but they really point to something incredibly complex underneath. What seems simple, remembering or, paying attention, involves this vast dynamic system in our brains.
And today, we're going to take a deep dive into exactly that, the intricate world of memory and attention. We've got this stack of fascinating sources you, our listener, provided, pulling from neuroscience, psychology, cognitive science, quite a range.
Yeah, it's a great collection. Our mission in this deep dive is to really unpack these sources, pull out the most important insights, and help you get a clearer picture of how these processes actually work in your brain.
Right. We'll highlight some surprising facts and hopefully uncover some really practical takeaways along the way. Okay, let's get into it. Let's start with the absolute basics. What is memory, like
Yeah.
fundamentally?
Well, from the perspective of the brain science in these sources, memory isn't really like saving a file on a computer. It's more fundamental than that.
Okay.
It's seen as any lasting physical or functional change in the brain's structure or activity that happens because of past events. Your brain is literally physically changing with every experience.
Wow. Right. So it's an active, dynamic process of change, not just like storage.
Exactly. And the sources are careful to point out that while those psychological models we often hear about, thinking of memory as distinct stages or
Yeah,
boxes.
like short term, long term.
Right. Those were
Yes.
useful starting points for research, definitely.
Yeah.
But they don't always neatly map onto these underlying brain changes. The biological reality is a bit more, well, interconnected and complex.
Okay.
What's truly fascinating, though, is how tightly memory is linked to learning. In a way, memory is the enduring result of learning. And these sources offer some great strategies for learning effectively, many of which directly leverage how the brain naturally forms memories.
Like, what goes beyond just reading something over and over again, which we know isn't great?
Right. Passive repetition isn't the best. It's all about active engagement. Things like taking notes in your own words, summarizing concepts, repeating information in different ways, not just rote memorization,
Okay.
and actively associating new facts with things you already know, linking it up.
Connecting the dots.
Exactly. And one of the most powerful methods highlighted is trying to teach the material to someone else.
Because you have to structure it, explain it clearly.
Precisely. It forces deeper processing. The sources even mention leveraging tools like AI language models as study aids, asking them to summarize a concept for you, or maybe trying to explain something to the AI.
Interesting angle.
But it's not just intellectual activity either. Regular short breaks, especially involving physical activity like taking a walk, are crucial.
Get the blood flowing.
Yeah, and it seems your neurons consolidate better when they're not constantly processing the exact same input stream. Even things like handwriting notes rather than typing is noted as beneficial because it engages motor areas more. And tools like mind maps, the Cornell note-taking method, those are also recommended for structuring information.
So it sounds like learning effectively is really about how you interact with the information, using both your mind and your body in a way.
Precisely. To get a little context, let's briefly look back. Early ideas about memory, way back in the 19th century, focused on associationism, this idea that mental states and memories were just bundles of sensory associations linked together.
Okay, like connecting the smell of baking bread with your grandmother's kitchen.
Sort of, yeah. And that thinking sounds like it directly led into behaviorism, right?
It certainly paved the way. Ivan Pavlov's famous work with dogs around 1902 was a key moment.
The bells and the salivating dogs. Yeah, exactly. He discovered classical conditioning, pairing a neutral stimulus like a bell, the conditioned stimulus, with an unconditioned stimulus like food, which naturally causes an unconditioned response, salivation. Eventually, the bell alone can make the dog salivate a conditioned response.
The dog learned the bell predicted food. Simple association.
Right. And building on this, figures like Watson and Skinner developed behaviorism, focusing purely on observable stimulus-response relationships. Their goal was basically to predict and control behavior. Watson's 1913 manifesto was a big part of that push.
But the sources note that even these early behaviorist models ran into trouble pretty quickly. Things weren't that simple.
No, definitely not. Phenomena like blocking, for instance. If a dog learns bell means food, it makes it harder for it to simultaneously learn that, say, a light also means food, even if they're presented together.
Huh. The first association blocks the second.
Kind of, yeah. Or second-order conditioning, where maybe a stimulus linked to the bell, say, the sight of the lab assistant who always rings the bell can also make the dog salivate, even without the bell or food.
Wow. So the association spreads.
And these aren't just limited to mammals. The sources mention second-order conditioning is even observed in bees.
Bees? Okay, that's surprising.
These complexities pushed researchers toward more nuanced explanations and eventually mathematical models like the Riis-Skorla-Wagner model or Markov processes and reinforcement learning theories to try and better capture these learning dynamics.
So we move from simple SR connections to like sophisticated mathematical ways of modeling how associations are formed and changed over time.
Exactly. Now, one of the biggest takeaways from these sources, and something that really helps explain why memory can be so quirky, is that it's not just one thing. It's not monolithic.
Absolutely crucial point. You're right. This deep dive makes it abundantly clear. Memory is a collection of many interacting subsystems, and they use different brain structures.
Which is actually really smart evolutionary design because it helps solve the plasticity-stability dilemma.
Okay, what's that dilemma?
Well, think about it. We need some parts of our brain to be highly plastic, able to change really quickly to learn new things instantly, like a new phone number or someone's name.
Right, flexible.
But we also need stability for our long-term knowledge and skills, things that shouldn't change easily, like how to ride a bike or who you are.
Got it. You don't want to forget how to walk every morning.
Exactly. So having different memory systems allows for both fast, flexible learning and slow, stable storage. Best of both worlds.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Let's look at how the sources break down these different types of memory then. We could maybe start with duration, how long things last.
Sure. So you have immediate or ultra-short memory lasting just a few seconds. This includes things like iconic memory for fleeting visual images or the phonological loop, which is like your mental echo chamber for sounds you just heard.
Okay, super brief.
Then there's short-term memory, often folded into the concept of working memory, which holds information for, say, minutes up to maybe a couple of hours if you're actively maintaining it, rehearsing it.
You're trying to remember directions someone just gave you.
Exactly. And finally, long-term memory, which can potentially last for years or even a lifetime.
And the sources specifically warn against that old computer analogy, primary versus secondary memory, RAM versus hard drive. That kind of thing.
Yes, they explicitly state that analogy isn't very helpful for understanding biological memory. It's just far more dynamic and interconnected than that.
Got it. Ditch the floppy disk model. Mm-hmm. How else do the sources categorize memory? Not just by time.
By function. There's recognition memory, simply knowing you've encountered something before, like seeing a face and knowing it's familiar, even if you can't place the name.
Okay.
Then there's declarative or descriptive memory. This is explicit, meaning you can consciously recall it and, well, declare it, state it.
Things you know, you know.
Right. And this splits into two main types. Episodic memory, which is autobiographical, remembering specific events with their time and place details, like your last birthday party or what you had for breakfast.
Your personal history timeline.
Exactly. And then semantic memory, which is your general knowledge and facts about the world, like knowing that Tokyo is the capital of Japan or that birds fly.
So remembering that you went to Paris is episodic. And knowing that the Eiffel Tower is in Paris is semantic.
Got it. Perfect distinction. The other main functional type is non-declarative or implicit memory. This is unconscious memory. It influences your behavior or performance without you necessarily remembering how or when you learned it.
Okay, like muscle memory.
Procedural memory skills like riding a bike or typing is a big part of it, yes. It also includes conditioned reflexes like flinching at a loud noise, habituation, getting used to a repetitive stimulus like traffic noise, or sensitization, becoming more reactive to something, and priming.
Priming? What's that?
Priming is where exposure to something influences your later responses, often without you realizing it. Like if I show you the word yellow, you'll likely be a tiny bit faster to recognize or name the fruit banana shortly afterward.
Ah, okay. Subtle influence. So you know how to do something, or you're influenced by something, but you don't consciously remember learning it.
Exactly, which links nicely to the next distinction the sources make, awareness, explicit versus implicit.
Right. Explicit memory is conscious, recallable. Implicit memory affects you unconsciously.
Correct. The sources note that emotional memory, which is heavily governed by the amygdala, often starts as implicit. You might feel fear or unease in a certain situation without consciously remembering the specific negative event that first caused it.
Mm.
Although connections can be formed that make some emotional memories explicit over time, even if they're sometimes prone to distortion, as we'll get into.
Okay. And finally, memory by time relation, looking back versus looking forward.
Right. Retrospective memory is recalling the past, which is what we usually think of as memory. But then there's prospective memory, remembering to do something in the future.
Like remembering to pick up groceries on the way home or take medication at 8 p.m.
Exactly. And prospective memory is still a bit of a mystery, actually. Early theories thought it needed constant mental monitoring, like keeping it actively in mind. But that feels really inefficient.
Yeah, you'd be exhausted.
Right. So the sources suggest a multiple process model is more likely. Your intention can be triggered spontaneously by internal thoughts, or maybe external cues like walking past the grocery store reminds you. Or even your body's biological clock can play a role.
Like those times you wake up just a few minutes before your alarm is set to go off. Is that related?
Sources speculate that could be linked, yeah. Maybe involving the tiny suprachiasmatic nuclei, our internal body clock, and potentially stress hormones like ACTH preparing the body. Prospective memory seems to rely heavily on having reliable external triggers or embedding the task really well within a routine.
And it's quite vulnerable.
It seems so. The sources mention several diseases, including schizophrenia, Parkinson's, MS, even sickle cell anemia, can specifically impair this type of memory, which really highlights how distinct it is from just remembering the past.
That is fascinatingly specific. It really drives home that memory isn't the single unified system at all.
Precisely. Which brings us to where all this complexity lives in the brain. While the entire brain is plastic and involved in some way, specific structures are particularly important for different memory types.
Okay, hit us with the key players from the sources. Where's the action happening?
All right, well, the cortex, the outer layer, is vital for storing long-term declarative and procedural memories. And it undergoes changes that support sensory and motor learning. The parietal lobe is involved in the visual spatial sketch pad. That's like your mental workspace for handling visual information. And it's important for short-term and associative long-term memory. The hippocampus. This one's famous. It's absolutely crucial, especially for spatial memory mapping your environment and for forming new episodic memories, those event memories, linking experiences together over days or longer before they potentially get consolidated elsewhere.
So remembering where you parked your car or what happened on your vacation last summer, that's prime hippocampus territory, initially at least.
Generally, yes, it plays a huge role in that initial encoding and consolidation. The amygdala is the main player for emotional memories, which, as we mentioned, are often implicit tagging experiences with feeling.
Fear, joy, that kind of thing.
Exactly. The striatum and basal ganglia are central for procedural memory skills, habits, and also conditioned reflexes, and even some instinctive behaviors.
Habits, eh?
Yeah, and the sources even point out something really interesting. The caudate nucleus, which is part of the striatum, has surprising links to OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and also the obsessive thoughts sometimes associated with being lovesick.
Wait. Lovesickness and OCD are linked to the same brain area involved in learning habits and skills. That's genuinely unexpected.
It really highlights how complex and interconnected brain function is, doesn't it? Things aren't neatly boxed off.
Clearly not. Who else is involved?
Other key players include the cerebellum, which is involved in motor learning and some forms of conditioning, the motor cortex itself, obviously for skill learning, and thalamocortical loops connecting the thalamus deep in the brain to the cortex. Then there's the prefrontal cortex right at the front.
The executive control center.
Pretty much. It's especially important for working memory. It acts like the conductor of the orchestra, managing tasks like spatial working memory, where things are, planning sequences, self-ordered tasks, holding object or verbal information in mind, and supporting complex analytical thinking. Different parts of the prefrontal cortex seem specialized for these different roles.
So working memory isn't just one place. It's more like the prefrontal cortex coordinating activity across different brain areas to keep information active and usable.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, zooming in even further, what's happening at the cellular or molecular level? How does the brain actually change?
Well, the fundamental biological basis involves changes at the synapses, those tiny junctions where neurons communicate. Memory involves strengthening or weakening these connections, making it easier or harder for one neuron to activate another.
turning the volume up or down on the kinetic.
Exactly. Changes in neuronal excitability, basically, how likely a neuron is to fire an electrical signal, are also key. And neurotransmitters and neuromodulators act like complex signaling molecules that regulate this whole dance of neural activity. While most synapses are chemical, the sources mention rapid changes might also involve the less common electrical synapses.
And for those slower, more longer-lasting changes, the stuff that sticks.
That's likely where long-term potentiation, LTP, and long-term depression, LTD, come in. Think of them as the primary mechanisms for tuning those synaptic connections over time.
LTP and LTD. Heard of those?
LTP strengthens connections. If two neurons fire together repeatedly, the connection between them gets stronger. Neurons that fire together wire together is the famous Hebbian idea. LTD does the opposite. It weakens connections that aren't used effectively. These are thought to be fundamental biological processes underlying slower forms of learning and the formation of long-term associations by changing the efficiency of those synapses.
So memory is literally physically etched in the brain by changing the strength and responsiveness of connections between neurons. That's amazing. Let's dive a bit deeper into some of these specific memory systems now. Episodic memory, first remembering specific events in context, your personal past.
Okay, so the sources really push back against the older idea of a single enneagram, like a localized memory trace for one specific event stored in one spot.
Like one file for your 10th birthday party.
Right. Instead, memory seems to be distributed across vast networks of neurons in different brain areas working together. Mm-hmm. And crucially, episodic memory isn't like playing back a video recording. It's an active process of reconstruction.
Reconstruction.
Meaning your brain is constantly fitting new facts and experiences into your existing memories. And that process can subtly change the memory itself each time you recall it. It's rebuilt, not just retrieved.
And this is a major reason why eyewitness accounts can differ so much or even be unreliable.
Absolutely. It's not necessarily intentional lying. It's the brain's rebuilding process being imperfect, maybe influenced by later information or suggestion.
Okay.
Endel Tolving, a major figure in memory research, described episodic memory as mentally traveling back in time, reconstructing events in their specific spatial and temporal context. Your autobiographical memory is the prime example.
Your life story.
Exactly. And crucially, the sources highlight that a major function of episodic memory isn't just recalling the past. It's allowing us to recombine pieces of past experiences to vividly imagine possible future scenarios.
Whoa. So remembering the past helps us simulate the future.
That seems to be a key function. Brain areas like the medial prefrontal cortex and its dorsal part are heavily involved in this perspective simulation.
Using the past to plan and predict. That's a powerful capability. How do we even begin to model these incredibly complex processes?
Well, computer models, particularly artificial neural networks, have become really useful tools. They try to mimic the brain's structure and function.
How they represent memory?
They represent memory not as stored data bits, but as patterns of activation across interconnected nodes. Think of them as simplified neurons and the strength of the connections between those nodes, which are like synapses.
And these models seem to replicate some key features of biological memory.
Yes, remarkably well in some ways. They show properties like distributed representation information is spread out across many nodes, making the memory robust to damage. If you lose a few nodes, the overall pattern can often still be recovered.
Unlike losing one bit in computer file, which can corrupt the whole thing.
Right. They also show content addressability. A partial cue, like a whiff of a certain perfume, can activate the full memory pattern associated with it. That explains why a small reminder can suddenly bring back a vivid, detailed memory. They can perform pattern completion, filling in missing details based on the stored pattern. And they can search for information very quickly, largely independent of how many memories are stored, which is unlike searching through files on a computer.
And biologically, the thinking is LTP and LTD are the likely mechanisms changing those connection strengths in the models.
That's the leading hypothesis, yes. LTP, LTD seem to be the biological implementation of adjusting those connection weights. Though the sources mention other ideas are still being explored, things like heposomes or even epigenetic changes affecting gene expression in neurons.
Okay, still some open questions there.
Definitely. And for a neural network model to really mimic biological memory well, the sources say it needs multiple interacting systems. Something for rapid, flexible learning, like the hippocampus, interacting with slower, more stable cortical storage systems. all mediated by neuromodulators that control plasticity, and sometimes incorporating structures like cortical columns, which are sometimes simulated as synfire chains, sequences of neurons firing reliably.
It paints a picture of these really dynamic, interconnected networks processing information at different speeds, different levels.
Yeah.
What about semantic memory? How do we form our general knowledge and concepts about the world?
The sources suggest semantic memory largely emerges from episodic memory. It's like an abstraction process.
How does that work?
Think of it like this. You have multiple specific episodic memories of different cats you've encountered over your life. Your pet cat, a neighbor's cat, a cat in a book. Your brain's networks gradually extract the common features, furry, four legs, pointy ears, meows, and abstract them into the general concept, cat, stripping away the specific contexts.
So the general knowledge gets distilled from the specific experiences.
Exactly. Computer models demonstrate how this can happen, how general knowledge can be formed by finding the statistical regularities across many specific instances.
And concepts themselves are represented by shared patterns of activation in these networks.
Yes. Concepts that are similar, like cat and dog, would have partially overlapping activation patterns, reflecting shared features like animal or pet. And neural networks can learn hierarchical structures, recognizing that cat is a type of animal, which is a type of living being, based on these overlapping patterns.
Is there real-world evidence for this kind of distributed concept representation?
Yes. The sources point to things like the fMRI semantic atlas developed by Jack Gallant's lab at UC Berkeley. They showed participants hours of movie trailers while scanning their brains and were able to build maps showing how different concepts like person, vehicle, animal, building activate distributed but consistent patterns across specific areas of the cerebral cortex. It's not just one cat neuron.
Wow. Visualizing thought patterns.
Kind of, yeah. Interestingly, the sources also note a possible hemispheric difference. The left hemisphere seems more involved in the language-based phonological links of concepts, the word cat, while the right hemisphere might be more engaged in a more intuitive, holistic, perhaps nonverbal understanding of the concept.
That makes sense. For those times you feel like you understand something deeply, but can't quite find the right words for it immediately.
To be related, yeah.
Okay, what about spatial memory? The brain's internal GPS system. This sounds fundamental.
Absolutely fundamental. It's how we navigate our environment, find our way around, remember where things are. And there was Nobel Prize-winning work in this area identifying specific types of neurons, mainly in the hippocampus and the nearby entorhinal cortex.
Right, I've heard of these. Place cells.
Place cells are a key one. They fire when an animal, or presumably a person, is in a specific location in an environment. Then there are grid cells, discovered later, which fire in a remarkably regular hexagonal grid pattern as you move through an environment, providing a kind of coordinate system.
Like longitude and latitude lines in the brain.
Sort of, yeah, a metric for space. There are also head direction cells, which fire based on which way your head is pointing, like an internal compass. And boundary cells, which fire when you're near the edges or borders of an environment. Together, these cells create a rich, dynamic map of space in the brain.
And this sophisticated spatial mapping system is why mnemonic techniques, like the method of loci, the memory palace, are so effective.
Absolutely. You're leveraging this powerful, evolutionarily ancient spatial mapping system. You associate items you want to remember with specific locations in a familiar mental space, like rooms in your house. And recalling the spatial journey helps you recall the items linked to each location.
Tapping into the brain's natural navigation skills.
Precisely. The sources even mention some exciting, more recent research reported in popular science outlets, suggesting these cell networks in the hippocampus might form complex, multidimensional structures, sometimes described mathematically as simplices. There was buzz about the brain creating 11-dimensional geometric shapes based on how groups of these neurons fire together to represent relationships in space.
11 dimensions. Okay, that's definitely more complex than just a 2D map.
It suggests our mental maps might represent space and maybe more in incredibly complex ways. And here's where it gets really interesting and kind of mind-bending.
Oh.
The sources propose that this powerful system, which clearly evolved for navigating physical space, might have been repurposed or co-opted by the brain for navigating and remembering abstract relationships between ideas, concepts, or even social hierarchies.
Wait, using the GPS system for abstract thought?
That's the idea. It could be used for inference, figuring out how two seemingly unrelated facts are connected based on their relationship within a kind of abstract mental space or map. Linking A to B and B to C lets you infer a link between A and C, potentially using similar neural machinery.
Wow.
This likely involves the hippocampus, entorhinal cortex, and prefrontal cortex working together, using both idiothetic cues, internal information, like your own movement or thought process, and allophetic cues, external information or landmarks in the idea space.
The brain using its navigation system to map not just places but abstract ideas. Mm. That's truly mind-bending. Okay, let's circle back to working memory. We mentioned it as part of duration, but the sources emphasize it's more than just temporary storage, right?
Right. Working memory is really best thought of as a psychological construct that combines short-term storage with executive control. It's like your brain's active mental scratch pad, the space where you hold information and actively manipulate it right now.
Holding and doing.
Exactly. It's essential for pretty much everything complex we do. Mental math, following multi-step instructions, understanding language, planning, switching between tasks, and keeping track of your thoughts even after an interruption.
So not just holding info, but doing things with it consciously.
Precisely. Major theories like the influential model by Baddeley and Hitch, or Cowan's embedded process model, or Erickson and Kinch's long-term working memory theory, all highlight this active element, tightly controlled by attention.
And its capacity limits are famous George Miller's magical number 7, plus or minus 2, from the 1950s.
That's the classic finding, yeah. We can typically only hold about 5 to 9 independent pieces or chunks of information in mind actively at any one time.
Though it's not always exactly 7.
No, later research shows it definitely varies. You can hold fewer items if they are complex, like long words or abstract concepts, maybe slightly more for simple visual objects. Word length matters too. People can remember fewer long Welsh digits than short English ones in the same amount of time, for example.
Interesting.
This working memory capacity is correlated with general intelligence or IQ. And while you can improve it somewhat with specific training, especially when you're younger, it unfortunately tends to decline somewhat with age.
Why is that?
The sources suggest it might be partly due to increased difficulty filtering out irrelevant information problems with inhibition as we get older.
Ah, okay.
But chunking information into larger, meaningful units is a key strategy anyone can use to overcome these limits, like remembering a phone number as 3 chunks, area code, prefix, line number, instead of 10 individual digits.
Right, makes it easier to handle.
And the sources note, there seems to be partial independence between visual and auditory working memory. You can hold some visual info and some auditory info simultaneously to an extent. And different brain hemispheres get more involved depending on whether the material is verbal or spatial.
And I have to mention this surprising detail from the sources. Chimps actually outperform humans on certain rabid visuospatial working memory tests.
They do. It's quite remarkable. In tasks requiring remembering the location of rapidly presented numbers on a screen, they are significantly faster and more accurate. Gives you a little perspective on human cognitive strengths and weaknesses.
I'm breathful now, blink.
Now, what happens when this incredibly sophisticated but complex system of memory and attention runs into trouble? The sources discuss memory disorders.
Right, like amnesia.
Amnesia. The classic memory loss scenario. Right. Amnesia is generally a loss of declarative memory, the explicit stuff, episodic and semantic. It can be organic, meaning it's caused by physical brain damage from injury, stroke, disease, or sometimes psychogenic, like dissociative fugue, which is often linked to severe psychological trauma rather than obvious brain injury.
Okay. And there are different kinds.
Yes. Retrograde amnesia means losing memories formed before the event that caused the amnesia, like someone getting a concussion and not remembering the hours or days leading up to it.
And it often shows that pattern, Ribot's gradient.
Yes, Ribot's gradient. Older, more consolidated memories are often more resistant to loss than more recent ones. So you might lose memories from the last few years, but still remember your childhood quite well.
So you lose recent memories first, and the oldest ones tend to hang on better.
Generally, yes, though it can vary. Then there's anterograde amnesia, which is the inability to form new declarative memories after the event.
Can't make new memories stick.
Exactly. The famous patient HM, who had his hippocampus removed to treat epilepsy, is the classic example. He couldn't form new episodic or semantic memories. He'd meet someone new and forget them minutes later. But he could still learn new procedural skills, like mirror drawing, even though he had no conscious memory of having done the task before.
Wow. shows the separation of those systems. What causes anterograde amnesia?
It's often caused by damage to areas critical for memory formation, like the thalamus, parts of the temporal lobes, the prefrontal cortex, and especially the hippocampus and surrounding structures in the medial temporal lobe.
And the sources note that anterograde amnesia also impairs the ability to imagine the future, not just recall the past.
Yes, that connection comes up again. If you can't form new memories of experiences, it seems you also struggle to recombine those elements to simulate novel future events. It really reinforces the idea that memory and future thinking are deeply intertwined.
That connection is really striking, yeah. Any other types?
There's also source amnesia. This is when you remember a piece of information, but you forget where or when you learned it. You know the fact, but not the source.
I feel like that happens to me all the time with things I read online.
It's very common. And it's linked to how easily memory can be influenced by suggestion. Because if you don't remember the original source, it's easier to misattribute it later. It can even contribute to something called memory distress syndrome, where people excessively doubt their own memory. And briefly, there's transient global amnesia, a sudden, temporary, but profound amnesia that usually lasts only a few hours, then resolves. Its cause isn't always clear.
Okay. The sources mention a computer model, the TraceLink model, as a way to potentially understand how these different amnesias might arise from damage in the system.
Yes. It's a computational model that tries to simulate the interactions between the cortex, seen as the long-term storage site, the hippocampus, crucial for rapidly forming new episodic links, and neuromodulation systems, which control the brain's ability to change its plasticity.
And how does it explain the different amnesias?
Well, in this model, if you damage or lose the connections from the hippocampus back to the cortex, the model shows symptoms similar to retrograde amnesia, particularly for more recent memories that haven't fully consolidated in the cortex yet.
Okay.
If you damage the neuromodulation systems or the plasticity mechanisms themselves within the model, it replicates anterograde amnesia. The system can't form the new links needed for new memories.
Can't learn.
Right. And if you damage the connections within the cortex itself, that models semantic amnesia, the loss of general knowledge, which is thought to be stored in those cortical connections. It's a useful framework for thinking about how failures at different points in this interconnected system could lead to the distinct patterns of memory loss we see.
That's really helpful for visualizing it. And of course, just normal aging affects memory too.
Yes, absolutely. Some decline in short-term memory capacity and processing speed is common. And sometimes, though perhaps less common than often portrayed in media, aging or certain neurological conditions can lead to confabulation.
Confabulation.
That's where the brain unintentionally fills in memory gaps with fabricated but often plausible sounding stories or details. The person genuinely believes these fabricated memories are true. It's not intentional deceit.
Just the brain trying to make sense of things, filling in the blanks.
Sort of, yeah. A kind of unintentional storytelling to create coherence.
And this brings us to perhaps one of the most unsettling but incredibly important points from the sources, just how fallible memory is and the sheer power of suggestion.
This is where that idea of memory as active reconstruction really hits home, and it has huge real-world implications. Memory is not a perfect recording device. It can be surprisingly easily distorted, contaminated, or even entirely fabricated.
And the sources give some pretty stark examples.
They really do. Compelling and, frankly, quite disturbing examples. They discuss the potential, even with well-meaning therapists, for psychotherapeutic techniques involving suggestion or guided imagery to inadvertently implant false memories of things like childhood abuse, sometimes leading to wrongful accusations and devastating consequences.
That's terrifying.
And they mention the specific case of Paul Ingram, a respected community member who, under intense interrogation using suggestive techniques, came to believe and eventually remember participating in horrific satanic ritual abuse crimes he almost certainly didn't commit. He ended up confessing and spent years in prison based on these implanted memories.
Just based on suggestion and pressure?
Wow.
That is terrifyingly easy to imagine happening now that you understand. Memory isn't fixed, it's malleable.
And perhaps the most dramatic experimental demonstration mentioned is the study by Julia Shaw and Stephen Porter from 2015.
What did they do?
They recruited healthy university students and over just 3 interviews using suggestive techniques like telling participants their parents had reported certain events, they successfully implanted rich, complex, false memories in them.
False memories of what?
False memories of committing a crime during their early adolescence, things like theft, assault, or even assault with a weapon that resulted in police contact. A staggering 70% of participants developed either a partial or a detailed false memory of the event, often providing vivid sensory details for something that never happened.
70%.
Yeah.
Just from suggestion in a few interviews, that's incredible and deeply concerning.
It really underscores the fragility. The sources emphasize how often DNA evidence has exonerated people convicted based solely on confident but ultimately flawed eyewitness testimony. Confidence is not a reliable indicator of accuracy.
So the very system designed to help us reconstruct the past can actually be manipulated or just naturally err to construct a false past that feels completely real.
Exactly. And this isn't just an individual phenomenon either. The sources talk about collective false memories, sometimes called the Mandela effect.
Ah, yes, the Mandela effect, where lots of people misremember Nelson Mandela dying in prison in the 80s.
That's the classic example, yeah. Large groups of people confidently misremember the same historical event or detail. This suggests shared cultural factors, perhaps amplified by media errors, speculation, or biases in how information is initially presented and later interpreted, can contribute to widespread confabulation.
It's not just our individual brains. Our shared information environment can shape these collective false memories too.
Seems likely. The sources give another example. Many religious believers incorrectly remember or believe that a specific Jesuit monastery was the only structure left standing near Ground Zero after the Hiroshima atomic bomb, seeing it as a miracle. But historical evidence and photos clearly show it was significantly damaged, much like other buildings at a similar distance. The narrative just took hold.
So cultural narratives can overwrite factual memory for large groups.
It appears so. Now, Daniel Schachter's work on the seven sins of memory provides a really useful framework for understanding these imperfections. He argues they aren't just flaws or bugs in the system, but often represent adaptive trade-offs, the flip side of features that are actually beneficial.
So memory isn't broken. It's maybe optimized for something other than perfect total recall.
That's the core idea. Let's quickly run through Schachter's seven sins.
Just simple forgetting over time. This isn't necessarily a bug. It helps us discard outdated or irrelevant information, making it faster to access important recent memories. Keeps the system from getting cluttered.
Makes sense. Clean out the old stuff.
Second, absent-mindedness. Lapses in attention leading to encoding failures, like forgetting where you put your keys because you weren't paying attention when you put them down. This saves cognitive resources. Attention is limited, and we don't need to encode every single mundane detail of our lives.
Right. Efficient, but sometimes annoying.
Third, blocking. That tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon. A temporary inability to retrieve information you know is in there. It's an access issue, often related to interference from similar information or insufficient cues. Usually resolved spontaneously. Frustrating, but temporary.
Very frustrating.
Fourth, suggestibility. Memories being vulnerable to distortion by misleading information or suggestion from external sources. As we just discussed, this is a big one. It's linked to priming previously activated neural pathways become easier to reactivate, which could be helpful for learning associations, but also makes us susceptible to incorporating false details.
The downside of plasticity.
Fifth, persistence. The flip side of forgetting remembering things you want to forget, especially intrusive memories of traumatic events, like in PTSD, while painful, this system likely evolved because remembering dangerous or highly negative events is crucial for survival. It also aids reflection and counterfactual thinking. What if I had done this instead?
Learning from bad experiences, even if it hurts.
Sixth, bias. Our current knowledge, beliefs, attitudes, or feelings distorting our memory of past experiences or opinions. We often unconsciously revise our past to align with our present selves. This helps maintain a coherent sense of self, boosts self-esteem, and allows us to adapt our personal narrative. We misremember past political views to match current ones, for example.
Making the past fit the present story we tell ourselves.
Exactly. And seventh, misattribution. Remembering information correctly, but misattributing it to the wrong source, time, or place. Like remembering a fact, but thinking you read it in a reliable newspaper when you actually saw it on social media. Or confusing details between different events. This probably helps prevent memory overload. Often the gist of the information is more important than recalling every single contextual detail, and generalization is often more useful than hyper-specific recall.
Those those are really insightful ways to frame our common memory struggles. They're not just failures. They're often the cost of having other valuable cognitive abilities.
That's Schechter's argument, yes.
Okay, so given all this complexity and fallibility, what factors from the sources are most critical for remembering things well? What actually helps?
Well, based on everything we've discussed, several things stand out. First and foremost, attention is paramount. You have to pay attention to information in the first place for it to have a good chance of being encoded into memory.
Can't remember what you didn't notice.
Exactly. Then, cues and context are vital for retrieval. Having good reminders or being in the same context where you learned something makes recall much easier. That's the principle of encoding specificity.
Learn it in the classroom, test it in the classroom helps.
Generally, yes. And reinforcement matters how useful, important, or emotionally significant the information is to you. Things that matter more or have stronger emotional tags tend to be consolidated better.
You mentioned emotion helps, but with a caveat.
Yes, moderate levels of emotion seem to enhance memory consolidation. Things that are mildly exciting or engaging are remembered better. But strong negative emotions, high levels of stress, anxiety, those actually hinder effective memory encoding and retrieval.
So being super stressed while studying is counterproductive.
Very much so. Not great news for last-minute cramming under pressure.
And perhaps the single most practical takeaway from all of this, especially for learning, consolidation requires rest.
Absolutely vital. Your brain needs downtime, particularly sleep, but even just quiet rest periods, to process and consolidate newly learned information into more stable long-term memory traces. Trying to cram information continuously without breaks doesn't work nearly as well.
So those study breaks aren't just for relaxing, they're for solidifying the learning.
Precisely. Frequent short breaks, incorporating movement, and even short naps can be really beneficial. The sources cite some fascinating older experiments, like Muller and Piljecker's work back in the early 20th century. They had people learn lists of nonsense syllables.
Okay.
One group learned a second list immediately afterward. The other group got a rest period. The group that rested showed dramatically better recall of the first list later on. The immediate second list seemed to interfere with the consolidation of the first.
Interference. Makes sense.
And a more recent study mentioned in the sources, involving patients with early Alzheimer's disease, was even more striking. They tried to learn faces. After a period of continuous activity, they could only recall about 7% of the faces. But if they had a one-hour quiet rest period immediately after learning, their recall jumped to 79%.
Wow. From 7% to 79% just by resting. That is incredibly powerful evidence for the brain needing that offline processing time.
It really is. And it leads to an interesting analogy the sources use, the Giogo principle, garbage in, garbage out, applied to the hippocampus, especially in our modern digital age.
Garbage in, garbage out, for memory.
Yeah, the idea is that the hippocampus, which is key for that rapid episodic learning and initial consolidation, has a limited capacity. If it's constantly bombarded with junk data, maybe highly stimulating, emotionally grabbing, but ultimately low-value information from social media feeds, endless notifications, clickbait.
Things designed to hijack attention.
Exactly. If the hippocampus is overloaded, processing that kind of garbage, it might actually hinder its ability to properly consolidate the more important systematic knowledge you're trying to learn, say, from reading a book, studying, or having a deep conversation.
That's a really modern and kind of worrying thought. It makes you seriously reconsider your digital information diet and habits.
It's definitely food for thought.
What about some of the more unusual or extreme memory phenomena the sources touch on briefly, beyond everyday memory?
Sure. They mention semantic networks or mind maps again, not just as study tools, but as useful conceptual metaphors for how our internal knowledge, beliefs, and even worldviews are structured based on interconnected information and associations.
Okay.
Relaxation techniques, sleep, as we've stressed, and meditation are all noted as generally beneficial for memory processes, likely by reducing stress and facilitating consolidation.
Good habits for brain health.
Then there are phenomena like hyperamnesia, somewhat controversial, but it's the idea that recall can sometimes improve with repeated testing attempts, even without new learning. And reminiscence, the experience of spontaneously recalling memories later that you couldn't access earlier.
And hypertimesia, often called HSM, highly superior autobiographical memory, that sounds like a superpower.
It's extremely rare. These individuals can recall details of events from their own lives, often linked to specific dates, with extraordinary accuracy and detail. But the sources emphasize it's usually specific to autobiographical memory. They aren't necessarily geniuses at remembering semantic facts or other types of information.
So They remember what they had for lunch on March 14th, 1998, but not necessarily the capital of Mongolia.
Potentially, yeah. It's very specific. Eidetic memory, what people often call photographic memory or auditory memory, is even rarer. And its existence, especially spontaneously in adults, is debated by researchers. It seems to be slightly more common in children, but usually fades.
The perfect snapshot memory might be mostly myth, then.
Largely, yes. The sources also touch on spontaneous thoughts, those ideas or melodies that just pop into your head, sometimes called mind pops. And, of course, the intense flashbulb memories often tied to shocking public events or personal traumatic experiences, PTSD.
Those memories that feel incredibly vivid and detailed, like a photograph was taken.
Right. Though research shows even flashbulb memories can be inaccurate or change over time, despite the high confidence people have in them. And this leads to one of the most complex and difficult to study phenomena mentioned. The life review, or flash sequences, sometimes reported during moments of extreme stress or near-death experiences, NDEs.
The whole life flashing before your eyes idea.
Exactly. The sources discuss some speculation on possible mechanisms, maybe massive adrenaline surges, widespread brain activation trying to find relevant memories for survival, perhaps even subjective time distortion, while acknowledging the significant ethical and objective challenges in studying this scientifically. You can't exactly induce NDEs in a lab.
No, definitely not.
They also note the historical and cultural link between such reports and certain belief systems, like ideas of a final judgment.
It's a profound mystery at the intersection of brain function, subjective experience, and maybe belief. The sources also briefly mention really cutting-edge research, like preliminary work on electronic memory implants.
Yeah, attempts to potentially restore or even augment memory function using brain-computer interfaces. Still very early days, but it shows the ongoing effort to understand and interact with memory systems.
A sign of how fundamental memory is to who we are, to our humanity. Now, we've touched repeatedly on how memory relies so heavily on attention. It feels like we can't fully understand memory without giving attention its due in this deep dive.
Absolutely. They're inextricably linked.
Okay, so if memory is where attended information eventually ends up and gets consolidated, attention is like the gatekeeper or maybe the spotlight, deciding what even gets in the door for processing in the first place.
That's a great way to put it. Attention is the process of selectively concentrating on one aspect of the environment while ignoring other things, or selectively processing information from the vast stream of sensory input and internal thoughts. It's got limited capacity. You simply can't attend fully to everything at once.
What you pay attention to is usually what enters your conscious awareness for deeper analysis.
Right. It's tightly linked to consciousness.
The sources use a well-known model from Peterson and Posner to break down attention into three main functional stages or networks.
Yes, it's a helpful framework. First, there's alerting. This is about achieving and maintaining a state of general arousal or readiness to respond. Being vigilant. This network is often linked to the neurotransmitter norepinephrine, originating from a brainstem area called the locus coeruleus.
Getting the brain ready to pay attention.
Exactly. Second, there's orienting. This involves selecting specific stimuli from the myriad options to attend to and filtering out others, directing the spotlight. This involves systems using acetylcholine, reflexive orienting movements like automatically turning your head to a sudden sound, creating spatial maps of relevance, and maybe linking the stimulus to your sense of self, involving areas like the posterior cingulate cortex, PACC.
Pointing the focus.
And third, there's executive control. This is the higher level management of attention. Resolving conflict between competing stimuli, actively filtering out distractions, like the classic cocktail party effect where you can focus on one conversation in a noisy room, planning actions, and inhibiting unwanted automatic responses.
So getting ready, pointing your focus, and then actively staying focused while consciously ignoring distractions.
Precisely. Those three functions work together. The sources also describe two main large-scale attention networks in the brain that cooperate. A ventral network, which seems more involved in automatic reorientation to unexpected but relevant salient things happening, like a car horn honking nearby, and a dorsal network, which supports more intentional, top-down, goal-directed attention, like deliberately focusing on reading this difficult paragraph.
So one grabs your attention automatically, the other lets you direct it on purpose.
And they interact and cooperate constantly to help us navigate a complex and unpredictable world.
Okay. And what's the cost of trying to attend to too many things at once? The dreaded multitasking.
Ah, multitasking. The sources are very clear on this. Task switching, which is what multitasking really is, has a significant cognitive cost. performance degrades. Divided attention, especially trying to do two complex tasks simultaneously that draw on the same resources or sensory modality, like texting while driving, or trying to listen intently to a lecture while also scrolling social media, is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to do well. Performance on both tasks suffers significantly.
The driving example is tragically relevant. Laws against texting and driving exist for a very good reason.
Absolutely. The cognitive load is simply too high, reaction times plummet, and awareness of the environment drops dramatically.
So when we think we're multitasking effectively, our brain isn't actually processing everything in parallel. It's just switching its limited attention resources back and forth very rapidly and usually quite inefficiently.
That's the consensus view, yes. The threaded cognition theory, which is based on the ACTR computational model of cognition, uses the analogy of multiple mental threads competing for limited processing resources, or modules, like vision, motor control, and crucially, working memory. Working memory is often seen as a major bottleneck in multitasking performance.
Makes sense. You can only juggle so much in that active mental workspace.
But the sources emphasize another critical, and perhaps often overlooked, drawback of persistent multitasking or distraction. It seems to significantly cripple your ability to properly evaluate incoming information, to think critically about it.
And this links back to that historical debate between the philosophers Descartes and Spinoza about belief.
Yes, exactly. It's a fascinating connection. Descartes thought we first comprehend information neutrally, then we consciously evaluate it and decide whether to believe it or not.
Seems logical.
But Spinoza argued something different. He proposed that understanding is believing, at least initially. When we comprehend a statement, we automatically, implicitly accept it as true. Actively rejecting false information, Spinoza argued, requires a separate, subsequent, effortful, analytical step.
So belief is the default, and disbelief takes work.
That's Spinoza's view, and the sources cite cognitive experiments that seem to support it. Studies show that when people are distracted, put under time pressure, or are multitasking, they are much more likely to accept false statements as true. Why? Because they lack the necessary cognitive resources or time to perform that effortful analytical step needed to question, evaluate, and reject the misinformation.
Wow, that is such a powerful and frankly quite sobering practical insight for anyone navigating today's information-saturated world.
It absolutely is. The key takeaway from the sources here is stark. To avoid automatically accepting and potentially believing false or misleading information, you need sufficient time and focused cognitive resources, which means avoiding distraction and multitasking to actively engage in that analytical process. You need to compare the information to what you already know, look for inconsistencies or counter evidence, consider the source's credibility, and actively seek out reliable, corroborating information. Multitasking effectively prevents that critical thinking process from happening properly.
So paying attention to your attention isn't just about being more productive or learning better. It's actually fundamental to critical thinking and protecting yourself from misinformation in the modern age.
Couldn't agree more. It's a crucial skill.
Well, this has been an absolutely incredible deep dive. It really shows just how complex, how interconnected, and how dynamic memory and attention truly are. They're definitely not passive systems, are they? They're active processes of change, filtering, reconstruction, simulation, even imagination.
Yeah, and we've seen why they're not perfect, why those sins of memory exist, but also how those imperfections might actually be functional trade-off, the cost of doing business for a flexible, adaptive brain.
And understanding the brain's architecture, the different systems, the role of things like LTP, LTD, the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex, it helps make sense of everything, from why a word is on the tip of your tongue to the frankly unsettling ease with which false memories can be created, why rest is so crucial for learning, and why true multitasking is largely an illusion that can actually make you more susceptible to believing inaccurate information.
These aren't just abstract brain facts, are they? They fundamentally shape our daily lives, our learning experiences, our sense of self, and how we perceive and interact with the world around us.
It really encourages you listening, to reflect on your own experiences. The memory quirks you have, why your recollections might differ so much from a friend's, how effective you really are when you think you're multitasking, and maybe how much rest you're actually giving your brain to consolidate everything you take in.
Yeah, maybe time to reconsider how you're using this limited attention budget each day.
Which brings us back perfectly to that provocative thought from the sources we touched on earlier.
Yeah.
This idea that our hippocampus, that vital brain engine for consolidating new systematic knowledge, might be constantly, chronically overloaded with junk data in the digital age.
Right. Overloaded by the sheer volume, the constant novelty, the emotional saliency of information pouring in from digital sources, news alerts, social media feeds, videos, and things expertly designed to grab your attention instantly, but which may not actually build deep, lasting understanding or coherent knowledge structures.
So the final question for you to ponder, what does that constant influx of easily digestible, often fragmented, often emotionally charged, transient information mean for our collective and individual capacity for deep learning, for critical analysis, for forming stable, coherent memories and knowledge in this digital age? Is our environment overwhelming our biology?
A really important question, and definitely something worth pondering long after this deep dive ends.
Indeed. Thank you so much for providing the sources for this truly insightful exploration. It's given us, and hopefully you, a lot to think about.